Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin. I'm in Berkeley, California today, and Bob is off on assignment, but I am joined today for another segment on State of the Resistance with Patrick Young. We talked to Patrick a couple of weeks ago. Patrick, welcome back to the Green and Red podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah. And for folks who don't recall, Patrick is a labor organizer, a climate organizer. He's worked with the steelworkers, the Teamsters, Rising Tide North America, has been the last few years very involved in a lot of direct action stuff in D.C., including Shutdown DC and more recently, the Movement Infrastructure Project. And so today we're going to be talking about some more. We're going to be talking about the State of Resistance. And so maybe we can just kick off with it was about a week ago, but we had a huge show of protest force here in the U.S. on May Day. We actually at Green and Red ran an encore episode of our History of May Day episode, assuming thousands, if not millions of people joined in the streets. There were marches all over the country. And I will also say this about May Day too. And so maybe, Patrick, this is something we can talk about. May Day also marked the end of the first 100 days of the Trump administration, which a lot of people seem to make a big deal about. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on one, May Day, and then two, the sort of end of the first 100 days, particularly since you are based in Washington.
Sure. I think that the much more interesting thing to talk about is the mobilizations that happened on May Day. And we've seen May Day is, as your listeners who listen to the History of May Day episode know, that is the original Labor Day. And it's the date that every other country in the world celebrates is Labor Day. Here in the U.S., we picked a day in September as a way to undermine and quell the communist influences of Labor Day. So it has always been a day for workers' rights mobilizations around the world and originally in the United States. More recently, really since the late 1990s and early 2000s, May Day has also been a major day for mobilization for immigrant rights. And this is particularly because many immigrants come from countries where we lift up the working class and our communities and fight back against corporate control in the right way on May Day. This year was one of the bigger, I would say, May Day mobilizations in recent history. Nationwide, there were more than 1,000 events in 800 cities and towns, and it just happened to be that there were more than 60,000 workers on strike on May 1st this year. And that didn't come out of nowhere. That came from some real institutional players in the organized left leaning in, particularly the two major teachers unions in the United States, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Educators Association, as well as a range of immigrant rights organizations, the Working Families Party, and Public Citizen, Move On, Chicago Teachers Unions, all saying, hey, this is really an important moment for us to throw down. It does come at the end of Trump's first 100 days. This is a can be a watershed moment within the early stage of the Trump administration. Because of that support, we saw some really large-scale actions in both the major cities that you expect, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, and also much smaller communities that you don't normally associate with May Day mobilizations, like Missoula, Montana, and Jacksonville, Florida, and parts of the country that we don't always associate with throwing down for these types of mobilizations.
So I was looking at, as I was preparing for this episode, I was looking at the news. I think I saw an NPR story where they're actually talking about a May Day mobilization in Jackson, Mississippi. And only 150 people turned out, but some of them were people who had voted for Trump and were out here because our Medicaid is getting cut. or they're, I'm really scared about what the tariffs are going to do for my job. And it's, I think we talked about this last time, but it's quite interesting to see this sort of like red state sentiment against the administration actually really beginning to brew.
Yeah, well, and I think we can expect to see a whole lot more of that, particularly as the reality of the tariffs starts to hit. We're seeing Seattle Harbor may or may not be empty. The goods, this is really the time when we're going to start to see the actual impact of before and after the tariffs. Just there's a long tail on this because it takes a while to move so much of the stuff that's coming out of the country. And then we combine that with the, you know, what's happening with the budget talks that are going on right now. And in the framework that the House and Senate passed, they're really looking at a budget that is, there's no way to make the numbers work without serious cuts to some of the programs that our communities really rely on, Medicaid, Medicare, and SNAP benefits. And that's going to be devastating to a lot of people. And when you look at like Medicare match rates in terms of the federal government's contributions to state Medicaid programs, that hits hardest in Alabama, in Mississippi, and some of the other deep red, deep south states, because these are also states that have experienced significant levels of poverty and huge populations that are relying on these services. So it's not surprising that we're going to see, that we have seen, that we're likely going to see a lot more people who were at one point Trump supporters coming out saying, you need to really sign up for this. I signed up for getting inflation under control. I didn't sign up for losing my health insurance.
Or I signed up to own the libs, not get owned by Trump. Actually, and thinking about this, another actually what's considered a part of the organized left is the Teamsters, thinking about the Teamsters, because Sean O'Brien definitely has some Trump affiliations. But we're also seeing the Teamsters are actually one of the unions that's going to be hit hardest initially by the tariffs, by goods not coming overseas and being unloaded at the ports to be put on their trucks. And UPS actually just laid, which I believe is the largest Teamster-run private shop in the country, just laid off 20,000 people. And so it's going to have a huge impact there for some of these like pro-Trump union guys.
Yeah, exactly. So UPS is the largest single employer represented by the Teamsters. But you go beyond that. Teamsters do the logistics work in moving things in this country. When we look at ships not coming into the ports or ships being turned around, many of the dock workers are ILWU and ILU on the East Coast. But once you get past the dock, those are Teamster terminal drivers, warehouse drivers, and Teamsters moving those products into intermodal transportation. It's going to have a huge impact on the entire logistics operation in the U.S. And that's why I think that Sean O'Brien is finding himself, I hope, I imagine, in a weakened position within his union, because his gamble on sucking up to Donald Trump and Josh Hawley and Mark Wayne Mullen, it's not playing out well for Teamster members. And that is a membership that it really wants to know what their organization did for them and is not afraid to hold their leadership accountable.
Yeah. And I find this whole dynamic just amazing to play out. And I'm assuming that like the Teamsters locals starting on the West Coast are probably pretty irate about this whole situation, and that'll probably spread.
Yeah. Turns out big labor is not a monolith. More than really any other union, there are major gradations in the political flavor of Teamster locals, from some very progressive ones on the coast and in the West Coast, the East Coast, the upper Midwest, where the union really was built, and then also some more reactionary local unions that have a much more conservative base. That's how we end up with the O'Brien Oz ticket, which is a little bit ideologically incoherent with TDU representation, Teamsters for Democratic Union representation, as well as some more traditional hard-nosed Boston business unionists.
Yeah. Just to kind of shift a little bit on this same track, just to talk about June 14th for a minute, which, you know, the backdrop here is, I believe that's Flag Day. It's also our dear leader's birthday. And he is calling for and they're having a military parade. They've obtained permits for it. They're expecting more than 6,000 soldiers, vehicles, helicopters. I could bore the people with some of what Trump has said about how it's going to display the greatest missiles in the world, the greatest submarines in the world. But we're also seeing a sort of mobilization in the sort of left progressive sphere as well, which is much more interesting stuff. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just Flag Day and Trump's birthday. It's the 250th anniversary of the formation of the U.S. Army, which is the excuse to be able to have a big military parade on that particular day. And many, a whole range of groups, actually a very similar list of groups as supported the April 5th, 5051 Hands Off Mobilization, are calling for what they're calling No King's Day on June 14th. And that is indivisible, our revolution, Social Security works, the State of America, Declaration for American Democracy. It's the usual suspects. And they are encouraging people to hold demonstrations in their towns across the country, whether it is a march, a rally, or some sort of other mobilization. The theme is No Kings. It is definitely set in opposition to the military parade. But what I think is very interesting and very smart is that there is no demonstration in Washington, D.C. that day. The idea is, okay, if the military is mobilizing in Washington, D.C., the spectacle that they create is going to be bigger than, this is the most well-funded military in the history of the world, the spectacle that they create is going to be bigger than anything that our movements are likely to create, other than in numbers. They're going to have 6,000 soldiers there. We expect tens, hundreds of thousands, many more people in other parts of the country. And it's also a recognition that counter-mobilizing against the right wing in its most organized moment, most organized state, in the belly of the beast, is reckless. It's going in, taking a rhetorical fight that you're not going to win. And so part of the test there is, how do we move the center of gravity outside of Washington, D.C. into the cities and towns and rural areas all around the country where people are being impacted by the crises that the Trump administration has created? So far, there are more than 100 mobilizations that are on the map. And this is more than a month out. So there's a lot of room and opportunity to grow. I think that we're likely to see some much larger mobilizations, particularly folks leaning into places like Philadelphia, where the Constitution Hall is, creates a really great split screen of a popular mobilization on one side of your screen and there's a military parade on the other side of the screen. And that is, I think that in the broader American imagination, this popular mobilization is a lot more what America is about and ought to be about than this relatively unprecedented military parade that happens to be on the same day as the birthday of our president.
There's a great historian who's still with us named Richard Slotkin. We actually interviewed him on the show last year, and he talks a lot about narratives. He talks about history in the form of narratives, and there's narrative around the revolution, and there's narrative around the sort of West, the sort of frontier. He also calls them myths. There's also one around the myth of a lost cause, which is the Confederacy, which is definitely what Trump and the MAGA folks have embraced. But then he also talks about the myth of the civil rights movement, which is actually something that we saw like Obama embrace as a national politician. And it'll be an interesting juxtaposition to see the myth of the lost cause, which I feel like is what will be happening when the military is on display, and then the myth of the civil rights with these mobilizations, because this, what you're talking about with this strategy actually very much reminds me of the civil rights movement, where they were actually, we need to be doing direct action and civil disobedience and in the segregationist South, or organizing in the North or on the West Coast or what have you. We actually can't take the battle to DC until we've much more built power in this decentralized way. I just did a couple of different historical references. But...
yeah, well, we'll always take the, and Boston, I didn't hear today. So
yeah,
that falls on me, onto you. And I mean, that's definitely is being manifested here. Listen, we need to get out of the bubble, and people are mobilizing in different places and specifically unexpected places. The other important piece of this frame, I think, is the No King's Day. There was a reason that the Continental Congress created an army 250 years ago. It was before we declared independence, but there's a group of people that really did not like kings. They didn't like the type of centralized autocracy and really cult of the individual that was embodied by the monarchy. And it is a useful rhetorical attempt to recast the players as really a return to the historical roots of the United States as fundamentally flawed and inadequate as those roots were, certainly different in many ways. And getting rid of a monarchy is a step towards progress.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting to me. I actually feel like thinking about it, and also if you've been reading the stories about the meltdown that's going on within the Pentagon, where Hegseth has been trying to purge senior military people for whatever reasons, like the real reason being that they're not loyal to the Trump agenda, but they use a whole lot of other different reasons like DEI or what have you. It actually sends a pretty interesting message actually to the people who we may be a little bit more aligned, like whatever, I don't want to say I'm aligned with the military, but there are those who are like fighting the Trump agenda within the Pentagon. And you can see that playing out with some of what's been happening, like leaks and people getting fired and things like that. And it sends an interesting message that like the officer corps, when they swear their oath to the Constitution. I believe if you're enlisted, you actually swear your oath to the president, is my understanding. And so this actually sends a very interesting message. No kings. Remember, you were formed to actually fight the monarchy, not support the monarchy, whether he's royalty or whether he's some diluted version of his own royalty or what have you.
And I think that the frame that we create is what helps us get news. And it also really helps us get people in the streets. The real question with any of these things are, okay, we just put X number of million people in the streets. How do we... One march is not going to topple the authoritarian project that, you know, that is happening right now. A couple marches are not going to do that. You know, at some point we need to move from mobilization to active resistance and disruption. So the question then is, all right, we've used whatever prayers we have to get people together into action. And what are the kind of organizational containers that people fall into or form or find themselves in to really take the next step, to be part, to not just be part of a mobilization, but to be part of a program of resistance. And the success or failure of these mobilizations that are happening right now, whether it was April 5th or May Day or June 14th, is not necessarily the number of people who are out in the streets. It is the number of people who find themselves in direct action trainings following these mobilizations, and the number of people who find themselves in organizing meetings and part of working groups and committees to actually move the work forward in new and powerful ways. That's why I'm particularly excited to see these mobilizations happening, not in one big place, but they're happening where people are at home. So that hopefully we'll create a bit of a jumping off point for some of that organizing to happen. But that is the real test for our movement right now, is moving from this mobilization to organization and resistance.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing. It's nice to see you're calling them containers. Containers like Tesla Takedown, which is actually directing people at a particular target. The next thing that I want to talk about is actually a, it's also another container, which is there was a sit-in at Columbia this week, but we're definitely seeing an anti-genocide movement, anti-genocide in Gaza movement, which is still very much fierce and fighting like in different parts of the country. And so these containers are places where you go to a march and you meet an organizer, you get signed up or what have you, and then you move into these other organizing containers. These, maybe they're organizations, maybe they're looser than that, but it's like an important space to go to, like to meet people and to get involved.
And that's a really, yeah, I think the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years really did an incredible job of actually creating containers and community and bringing people together to cultivate leadership and some semblance of organizing structures, and really to be able to walk and chew bubblegum at the same time, where we're dealing with the crises that are happening here in the United States, but also continue to rise to the moment to respond to the ongoing and in many cases worsening genocide, is a testament to the strength of that movement. A big question is where the politics land. There's a great, I think that movement has had a great program for pushing weak Democrats, pushing against the Biden administration, the taking a pivot to responding to a just openly Zionist Trump administration is, it seems like in many ways, it's running up against a brick wall where, you know, last year there was opportunities to figure out how to find gaps and create divisions within the elite. That's a major challenge that I think that movement is facing in this particular moment. But I think you want to talk about Columbia, so let's talk about Columbia.
Yeah, and this week, students at Columbia actually did a sit-in library. About 79, 80 people got arrested. Stories are that the police, the people who refused to cooperate, people who refused to get their IDs, the police arrested everyone who wouldn't give their IDs. We've been seeing still a lot of anti-genocide activity happening, actions happening all over the country, really. It's being quite intersectional with a lot of other movements. But it's always notable when these things that happen at Columbia, because that's where a lot of this stuff started last year, the encampments and things like that. But I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how this might impact anti-genocide movements going forward.
Yeah, so I think that when we saw the Senate happen last week, Columbia as an institution has learned all of the completely wrong lessons for dealing with a dictatorship and the authoritarian Trump Rubio regime. I guess when we get banned too, the students in many ways learned a lot of the right lessons. And when you go back and kind of read the narratives of what happened and watch some of the video, okay, so there's this sit-in, then campus police and at different points NYPD come in and they say, okay, you got to get out of here. And At some point, I've been part of sit-ins where we're going to go occupy the state for a while, and then when they tell us to leave and they're really serious, we're all going to leave, and sitting relatively, we don't really need to be concerned. What it seems to be is that the real sticking point was that you got to get out of here and you got to show us your student IDs. And that was the students saying, wait a minute. So you're either going to arrest us now, we're having a sit-in, we're occupying space, or you're going to let us go, we're going to give you our ID, and now we're going to get a letter in the mail or in our email in 3 days saying that we're being brought up on university charges and facing, in some cases, listen, these universities, when they attack their students, they're really playing with fire right now, because that means criminalizing your students means setting up young people for detention and deportation in really draconian circumstances. It's not surprising. Like, why would anybody show your ID in order to be allowed to leave this demonstration that's happening, when we've just seen the behavior of this administration, of Colombia? If you capitulate a little bit, it doesn't put you in a better position. You're still just as fucked.
Yeah. And both administrations, right? The Colombia administration and the Trump administration. If you cooperate, you end up in a detention center. If you're not a citizen, you end up in a detention center in Louisiana.
This is also why.
And Colombia is the one who gave Mahmoud Khalil's name to the Trump administration, too. So,
yeah, they gave Mahmoud Khalil's name to the Trump administration. The Trump administration also sent them this letter in March with a set of demands. You need to do all these things. We're taking away $400 million a year funding. And their interim president eventually said, okay, yeah, we'll do all these things. We'll let the Department of Education have a ideological purity review of all of our curriculum, and we'll militarize our campus, and we'll do all the things that you're asking to do. They folded. And then the Trump administration still withheld their funding. So that sends a really strong message. It was part of the reason that you saw Harvard and other universities saying, no, we're not going to do these things you asked for, because you're going to fuck us over anyway. So why would we make it easier for you at this point?
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna wrap it there. One other thing I want to say, and I'm going to just throw this out there around the state of resistance, and I know you haven't seen this, but I just want to like tout this, which is that this week was the sort of penultimate arc of Andor, if you're watching that, which is a Star Wars prequel, which is a great show, really very sophisticated show that gets into like how to build a rebellion and how to build a revolution. But this week's arc was really a metaphor for Gaza and how revolutionaries are fighting against the evil empire, but then also how liberal politicians that are caught up in the underbelly of the empire actually stand up and have backbone. And on social media, it was a lot about how if we only had liberal politicians that had this kind of backbone, I would actually argue that people like Rashida Tlaib actually did stand up and fight the way that in which like Senator Mon Mothma did on Andor this week. But we're going to actually have a bigger show on that really soon. But I just want to throw that out there with the state of resistance, because on the Green and Red podcast, we think pop culture is an interesting commentary on the state of the world.
When you want to do the Taylor Swift episode of Green and Red, I'll be right there.
We will interview super fan Patrick Young on our Taylor Swift episode. How about that?
Sounds good.
Yeah, Bob would probably be excited about that. So, folks, we've been talking with Patrick Young, organizer, troublemaker, good troublemaker. We'll put in the show notes some of the links for the No Kings Day, things like that. But, Patrick, it's fun talking with you. And I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon, because there's a lot of stuff going on right now. Folks, if you like us, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to this on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, become a donor by going to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And we will talk to you all again soon.
All right.